hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is a McCullough Report. I have a breaking interview. Dr. Mary Taley Bowden, an otolaryngologist in Houston, Texas, one of the plaintiffs in the critical case of basically doctors, Apter, Bowden, and Merrick versus the FDA. Dr. Bowden, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter.
What happened late Thursday night?
It's very exciting. We've been waiting and waiting. We knew it was coming, but the FDA finally begrudgingly agreed to the terms of our settlement, and that was to remove all of their misinformation, propaganda, posts on social media and on their website regarding ivermectin and COVID.
Does this represent a capitulation?
Well, yes and no. I mean, they, in terms of what their the actions they have to take, is definitely a capitulation. Now, publicly, you may have seen the statements that they've made, and they are not publicly admitting to doing anything wrong. But the fact that they have to remove these posts is pretty monumental.
Well, if the FDA truly believed that ivermectin was only a horse dewormer and that people should not use it for COVID-19, why wouldn't they stand behind those statements?
Right. Well, they can't, right? They can't do that and save face. They know that the statements are false. It's just, you know, they're just very hard for them to admit that they did anything wrong. And it's big news. I mean, it's our first major win in this battle that we've been up against the last 4 years. And it's, you know, that was their most viral and famous tweet ever. I believe it reached about 24 million views in 1 week. So it's a big deal. You know, we've gotten some criticism, like, why did we settle? But we looked at what would have happened if we weren't sure how long it would drag on. Everything, we need to keep COVID current. We need to keep fighting this. There wasn't much to gain by continuing to fight. We looked at discovery, but, you know, 2 weeks ago, I'm still in the midst of my battle with the Texas Medical Board, and we're in discovery right now. And I was pretty excited. I was like, oh, I'm going to get, you know, answers to all these questions I have. And, you know, they just weren't willing to give us anything. And so that's what, you know, we anticipated with the FDA. That's what our lawyers anticipated as well. So we decided, you know, our goal with this lawsuit was to stop interference of the doctor-patient relationship from the FDA and set a precedent. And that's what we did.
Well, the case, as I recall, originally was filed in a lower court, and it was dismissed based on this principle of sovereign immunity. Like, you can't sue a government agency. And then it was overturned in an appellate court. And so it was game on of Apter, Bowden, and Merrick versus the FDA. And the FDA, we don't need to leave them nameless. So it's Robert Califf, who's the current commissioner of the FDA, somebody who I know, who previously was a well-respected cardiologist. He had already done one term as FDA commissioner. And also his supervisor, which is HHS, and that's Becerra, who's the current secretary. So who volunteered the first move on the settlement? Was it the FDA or was it your side?
Oh, yeah, it was definitely the FDA. So after we won in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which allowed us to continue our case, went back to the district court with Judge Jeffrey Brown. Mm-hmm. And then the FDA appealed again based on standing. They said that we did not have standing. And the three of us, the judge allowed me to continue with standing. So we pushed on against all odds. Most people thought we weren't going to win this. So for us to get as far as we did was really amazing.
It certainly was. And in the end, the settlement, and it looks to me, it's just as an observer, a great victory. Now, essentially, the FDA was wrong to mislead America, mislead the world on ivermectin. And that messaging, in some circumstances, must have dissuaded the use of ivermectin, either by a physician to prescribe it or a patient to take it. Do you think that the FDA really is responsible for lives lost to some degree in the pandemic?
Most definitely. Most definitely. I mean, I saw it daily, the hurdles that I had to overcome to prescribe ivermectin. It created important delays in care. But not only as a physician, I mean, hospitals were using the FDA's stance. They were using that as an excuse not to give patients who are dying in the hospitals ivermectin. Courts, so patients who are taking these hospitals to court over the ivermectin, patients were losing court battles because of this FDA stance. So it is a big deal.
Do you think that this will percolate down to pharmacies dispensing it and then hospitals, you know, who are still forbidding it? Do you think this will kind of overturn all of that?
It's going to be interesting. I'm very curious to see what happens. I have noticed a slight softening in the stance of the pharmacists, but the only thing they're doing now is they're saying, well, we need pre-authorization. So that's how they're getting away with it. Just, you know, it's a cheap generic drug. We shouldn't need pre-authorization, but that's their latest trick. But it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next month after this ruling.
I have to tell you, yesterday, which is simply 2 days after this settlement with the FDA, I prescribed ivermectin for an obese patient, severe case of COVID. She had been hospitalized previously. She was really sick now, so I was worried about her. And I had prescribed the 12 milligram compounded capsules, which is kind of standard on my pick list in my electronic medical record. And it usually goes to a community pharmacy, but the patient directed it to just a standard chain pharmacy, and immediately it was held up. The other drugs went through, but immediately it was held up. And I said, here we go again. They could have easily just converted to the 12 milligram tablets, and, you know, pharmacists do this all the time. So I decided to hold a day or so and then go through a community pharmacy. So I think there still will be headwinds against ivermectin. But in many ways, Pierre Corey was right in his book when he says there was a war on ivermectin, and a lot of it was waged by the FDA. And thanks to you and Dr. Apter and Dr. Merrick, you showed great courage and tenacity and just the relentless, you know, pursuit of medical truth and what's right and wrong. So on behalf of the audience, certainly for America Out Loud Talk Radio, McCullough Report, and Courageous Discourse, Substack, we want to thank you so much for your tireless work in this area. Do you have any final comments for our audience?
Well, the war is not over. This is one tiny step, and we've just got a lot more fighting to do. And the next step is to get the COVID shots pulled off the market. And I just want to mention our growing list of politicians, elected officials, and people running for office who are all simply stated that the COVID shots are too dangerous and need to be pulled off the market. And if your audience could go to our website, AmericansForHealthFreedom.org, and share it with your representatives, share it with 10 representatives today so we can get the word out. The list keeps growing, but we need it to continue.
Well, I'll let that be the last word. And again, thank you for joining us on the program.
Thanks so much, Peter.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is a McCullough Report.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Often, there are no symptoms. But left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. It's time to fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar that you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Developed by world-renowned scientists and backed by 15 years of research, HealRight is effective, but it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. Step out of the statistics and use food as medicine. Visit HealRight.com/OutLoud or AmericaOutLoud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Millions of Americans are needlessly suffering from the long-haul effects of the toxic spike protein. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company designed their spike support formula to counteract harmful spike protein from COVID-19 and vaccines so you can feel your best. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is the McCullough Report. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. It's my great pleasure to bring to the show, and the first time on, but we've been communicating for years, Dr. Sean Downing. And Sean's an internal medicine physician, also board certified in pediatrics. Sean, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. It's an honor and a privilege to finally meet you.
And you know,
thank you for all the great work you do.
Thank you. Well, same to you. We meet, you know, on Zoom, and then later on we meet in person at meetings, and it's been a long haul over 4 years. Tell us a bit about your background.
Well, my background is I'm an internist here in Sarasota, Florida. I'm an attending physician at Sarasota Memorial Hospital. I'm in private practice. I'm board certified in internal medicine and pediatrics. I did my undergraduate work at University of Massachusetts and went to medical school at Georgetown University and did my residency at Brown University and at Rhode Island Hospital and Hasbro Children's Hospital. So I was a National Health Service Corps scholarship and did my payback in Nashua, New Hampshire for 3.5 years and then moved to sunny Sarasota, Florida, you know, for the weather and for a job.
Wow. So we have a similar background. I went to Baylor undergrad and then Southwestern. I went to my residency at University of Washington in Seattle. And I also had a public health service and a payback for 3 years. So I was stationed in northern Michigan and I guess we were about 8 hours away from Chicago, 6 hours away from Detroit. And I did that with another student from Duke University, and he was Chuck Williamson was my partner. But those were the good old days, I guess, when you know, people did public service, and I was young, probably like you were young, and I don't know about you, but I felt like I learned a lot, doing rural medicine.
I learned an incredible amount, actually, because most, as you well know, most of my patients at that time did not have health insurance, so there were a lot of workarounds to find the cheapest medications and the generic alternatives to branded medications that would work almost just as well, but would be quite affordable. So it was really quite an enriching experience, even though it wasn't a rural setting. I was actually in Nashua, New Hampshire. About 80% of my patients had English as a second language. So it was really a very rich experience, and it helped me become a better physician.
Wow. What was the population there? How big?
Oh, my guess at that point was probably about 400,000 would be my best guess.
Okay. Yeah, I was up in Roscommon County, and I think the service area was about 40,000. So it's a lot.
It was more of an urban environment. Yeah.
But I can tell you, I think the rural medicine experience and having to, rely on your own skills, your clinical skills, and the ability to empirically make decisions and, you know, not necessarily have an attending physician or someone else, you know, in a sense, telling you what to do, was a great learning experience. And sure enough, here we were, you know, when the COVID-19 pandemic, working separately, but, you know, we both took an interest in ways of treating the illness and helping people avoid hospitalization and death. So how did you approach acute COVID-19 early on?
Well, early on, I didn't really have a whole lot to do, as you can imagine, as we were locked down. And I became quite interested in it and started doing a little bit of research. And I thought, what better place to look initially than clinicaltrials.gov? So I went to the website. I started looking at what were people thinking about, what were the scientists thinking about. And I came up on a couple of things. One of the drugs was colchicine. There was a study that was enrolling patients out of Canada called the Cole Corona study. And then there was actually another, and then when I further searched that, there was a paper published with not many subjects, only about, I think, only 9 or 10 subjects out of northern Italy where colchicine was actually used clinically. And it did result in northern Italy, where it was very, where that variant was very dangerous, and the population was very old. It resulted in people who took colchicine with, did not have any deaths or intensive care unit admission. So that was the first step, and as it started to evolve, it became evident to me that it was the inflammatory reaction that was actually making people ill and not the virus itself. And so that's when I began looking at other types of pathways that could be inhibited simultaneously in order to prevent the cytokine storm, which is what made people ill.
And, you know, while you were doing that, I was thinking along the same lines. There was such an interest in antivirals, right? So the focal point was, well, let's stop the viral replication. And what you were saying is, let's look at the inflammation. Now, for our listeners, colchicine is a drug we've used for gout for a long time. It's standard of care in pericarditis, and it inhibits microtubule assembly in granulocytes or white blood cells, particularly those white blood cells that co-localize in the serosal surfaces of the organs, the pleura, the pericardium, and actually in the lungs themselves. So it's quite interesting that you're early honing in on colchicine. I was doing the same thing. So tell us more about what you looked at.
Well, I started looking at inflammatory pathways. As you all know, every biological system has an accelerator and a brake. And when these systems get imbalanced, and in the case of COVID-19, it was the inflammatory system that was out of balance. It was pro-inflammatory. So it became evident to me that if you could inhibit multiple pathways at the same time, then you could prevent this cytokine storm, which is what actually got people ill. The way I describe it to people often is that COVID-19 is like a campfire. Okay, it takes nothing but a bucket of water to douse a campfire, not much at all. But what was allowed to happen was that we allowed this through mismanagement. Ultimately, from Washington, D.C., we ended up mostly allowing that campfire to become a forest fire before anything was done. And also, one of the faults that I found with a lot of the early studies was that one single drug was being used for setting whether it was effective or not. And an example I'd like to I speak about is it's like a river with a number of different tributaries. If you have this substrate and you block one of the tributaries of the anti-inflammatory pathway, but you have two other inflammatory pathways open, the substrate, which happens to be arachidonic acid, will just flow down the open pathways. So multiple inhibition of and pro-inflammatory pathways was necessary. And the earlier, better as well, because once the cytokine storm was activated, that's when people became critically ill.
And so what drug targets do you think, you know, early on were you thinking would complement colchicine?
Well, I was very fortunate to have a patient very early on, and I'll never forget this because it happened on March 28th, 2020. I had a woman call me while I was watching CME online, and she asked me if I could be her and her husband's doctor. And I said, "Oh, absolutely." She said, it was classic. She said they were in Europe earlier in the month. And then returned to New York and then became more symptomatic, and then unfortunately came on a plane down to Sarasota. Eventually, he became the husband became so sick that his wife, despite his objection, called 911. Of course, he was brought to the emergency room and immediately intubated and brought into the ICU. She, on the other hand, was well enough to stay at home, and I began to treat her with hydroxychloroquine, with colchicine, with montelukast, and aspirin. And over a period of about 10 days, she recovered completely at
Wow.
home. Now, her husband, unfortunately, as he was brought in to the ER, was immediately intubated, like most everybody was at that point in time. And this man had had every known complication from the cytokine storm. He initially had multi-lobar pneumonia, and he ended up going into renal failure. Also, went into complete heart block. It had to be resuscitated. He had a pacemaker placed. He had every known complication of COVID-19 that you could imagine. For me, it was an incredible learning experience. I was able to watch him on a daily basis. I'd go in and visit him three times a day and see what was going on. And this is where I got the idea of using aspirin at very high doses. When he was on renal replacement therapy, I would be sitting in the ICU pod, and there were eight beds in the pod. I was amazed to see that every other patient at this time in March, April of 2020 was on dialysis. Not only were they on dialysis, but the dialysis filters were clogging. They were getting blocked, and there was a shortage. So initially I started thinking, well, gee, how can we get more of these filters? I mean, but then I started thinking, why are these filters clogging at this point in time if these people are fully anticoagulated on dialysis? And it became evident that it had to be platelet activation.
Mm.
And it was at that point that I added aspirin. And the last thing that I added onto the protocol that I started to use was montelukast, because it inhibits a different pathway, which is the lipoxygenase pathway. Not only that, but it also, through molecular modeling, it was noted that it could potentially inhibit the RNA polymerase as well. So mm-hmm. I added montelukast, aspirin at a higher dose that is traditionally used, in colchicine. And I was doing that for a period of about from March through July for my own patients, and for anybody from word of mouth who called, I would just treat them empirically. And of all of those people, I had no hospital admissions. I
Nice.
Had several people who required oxygen therapy at home. But other than that, everybody stayed out of the hospital.
So they...
Yes, go ahead.
You know, the brilliance of this is that you didn't kind of follow this in a sense, distraction on the antivirals. I can tell you, I always had aspirin in the McCullough protocol, even from its first publication at 325. I was paying attention to these cardiac events that were happening afterwards, and to some degree, the blood clotting. I always had full anticoagulation in the protocol, but the one drug I didn't have, and I always had colchicine in from the beginning, but the one drug I didn't have in, but I found myself using as the add-on so many times, was Singulair or montelukast. A lot of people know it as Singulair. It's now generic. This is a simple medicine, 10 milligrams a day. And what I found is that not only did it play a role in this whole cytokine storm, but it was the go-to drug for that persistent cough that people would have. People would have COVID. They said, listen, doc, I'm okay if I just stop coughing. We try all kinds of cough syrups, Sean, and nothing would work. And I put them on Singulair and the cough would be silenced.
Well, I agree. I think it's a great drug. It's underutilized. My criteria that I used for coming up with this protocol was, that number one, it had to be orally administered. Number two, it had to be cheap. And number three, had to have a very long history of safety. Those three drugs do it. And I started, and that's why I started to do it. Eventually, what happened was I was convinced that early treatment was absolutely key. The sooner, the better, because of the, like I said, the campfire analogy. The people that I was seeing in the hospital were too, I figured were too late. Cytokine storm had already occurred. The horse was out of the barn. What I wanted to, the people I wanted to get were the people that were before the cytokine storm were had the risk factors, were sick enough and could respond to it. And they usually were older people with medical issues. So I came up with the idea of, because at this time there was a shortage in 2020, there was a shortage of testing materials. So our emergency room was not testing people for COVID-19, for excuse me, for SARS-CoV-2, because of the shortage. They did not want to be known as a testing center and be inundated and not be able to treat anybody for COVID-19. So I approached the laboratory, the head of the laboratory at the hospital and the head of the emergency room at the hospital as well. And I said, well, look, it doesn't make much sense for these people who are coming in really sick to the emergency room not to test them. And I volunteered. I said, look, if you go, if you test them, if you think that there are high likelihood of there being of them being positive, then send me the results, because at this point it was a 24-hour turnaround with PCR, and I will call them. And I will screen them and I will treat them if they want to be treated. And so we started that in August of 2020. And this was after there was the proof of principle actually occurred for the case study report that I think you have, where the triathlete calling from rural Vermont in April of 2020. He was getting sicker and sicker, and I decided to treat him with montelukast, aspirin, and colchicine, and he recovered within 3 days. And he wanted to
Nice.
go running within 5 days. So I was like, okay, it looks like this works. So then I wanted to apply it with a different group. And at that time, Dr. Galwankar, who was an ER attending, he encouraged me to publish that report, and he was instrumental in that report getting published, and had a number of scientific colleagues review the paper and make excellent comments and additions to it. So at this point, I think the proof there was the proof of principle. And so then over the next year, we would get from the emergency room results on SARS-CoV-2 testing, and I would call them. And over the course of a year, we reached out to approximately 2,000 people that had been to the ER, and 600 of them, we would call them if they were positive or negative for SARS-CoV-2. We had about 600 that were positive. Of those 600, approximately 130 people we treated. And we had two hospitalizations and no deaths.
Oh, brilliant.
Expert opinions, honest debate, and in-depth investigations are what you've come to expect from AmericaOutloud.news. We don't shy away from speaking the truth boldly and plainly. All that's missing is the propaganda that has infected legacy and social media. Get the best of down and dirty, wholesome American speak. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
One of the biggest advances in nutraceuticals and supplements is Healthy Cell. And the Healthy Cell line is extensive. I typically focus on the microgel technology, three major products here: Immune Super Boost, The Focus, and Recall. and then the REM sleep supplement. Each one of these is complementary, and they can have a role, I think, in the health of your life each and every day. I know they do in my case. Many of you know, after COVID-19 twice, I spent almost the entire year in 2022 with an upper respiratory tract illness. Now, thankfully, and I've been diligent with the Immune Super Boost in the morning, followed by Focus and Energy, and then in the evening time, the REM sleep supplement. The microgel technology works, and boy, does it work fast. So go to our website, America Out Loud Talk Radio, find the banner bar for Healthy Cell, click on it, and that'll take you to the site to get a discount on your purchase of all Healthy Cell products. So let's get real, let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio.
Trouble concentrating or recalling information is frustrating, embarrassing, and kills productivity. Nutrition company Healthy Cell created Focus and Recall to boost your brain power. And unlike other supplements that don't work, Focus and Recall is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra absorption of science-backed ingredients to help you immediately sharpen focus and strengthen recall. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order, risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
You wouldn't go a day without brushing your teeth or washing your hands. What about washing your nose? I mean, your nose does filter the air you breathe, air loaded with bacteria, viruses, and irritants. Make nasal hygiene part of your routine with Clear. No messy bottles to fill, no drowning sensation. Clear is a natural drug-free saline with the added benefit of xylitol, which blocks bacterial and viral adhesion. Available in stores and online at clear.com. That is X-L-E-A-R.com.
World-class care from doctors you can trust, all from the comfort of your home. That is One Wellness. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company launched the One Wellness membership to provide free monthly supplements and unlimited telemedicine access with doctors that share your values. The Wellness Company's chief medical board designed every supplement and medical protocol with your health in mind. From groundbreaking supplements like the Spike Support Formula to unique care like Freedom from Big Pharma. Join a healthcare system that puts your health and well-being above the interest of Big Pharma's bottom line. It's the way healthcare should be, with a company that shares your values. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first month of One Wellness.
Now, in that, this is early on. Well, were you using any steroids at that time?
No, well, the recovery trial came out, I think, in the summer of 2020. So, as you know, There was the potential of there being a detrimental effect if the patient wasn't hypoxic. There was a very positive effect, a decrease in mortality, if the patient was hypoxic. So these people that were being discharged home were not hypoxic.
Mm-hmm. So they weren't.
So you had to be hypoxic in order to be admitted to the hospital at that time.
Right. So
anyway.
So in your protocol, they weren't getting outpatient steroids then?
Initially, they weren't.
Okay.
It's kind of, since we were doing this over the course of a year, the ER physician started to catch on that they needed to do something. Mm-hmm. And as I would be getting the records the following day, towards the summer of 2021, fall of 2021, some ER physicians were sending people home on prednisone and Zithromax. And I noticed that trend, and remarkably, people were getting better on that combination as well.
Mm. Well, you know, it's in my book, Sean. My dad got COVID in April of 2020. And fortunately, the PA, they allowed me to kind of give the orders. The doctor literally just walked off the nursing home. It was terrible. And but we didn't know about steroids. So my dad never got steroids. And so he got a little different version of McCullough protocol. But it's interesting that doctors Sankaresh Chetty in South Africa also was frontlining Montelukast. So he had a different protocol. He never used hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin. So he used promethazine for its antihistamine capabilities, montelukast, and aspirin. What was the dose of aspirin you were using?
So the dose of aspirin was 650 milligrams every 4 to 6 hours.
Wow. So that is high dose. You know, that's the dose that in the old days that was used for acute rheumatic fever.
Right.
Yeah.
And it worked fine. I didn't have anyone, in fact, have a GI bleed. I mean, this was a short course anyway. It was usually about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's obviously for its antipyretic features, but primarily the irreversible inhibition of cyclooxygenase 1 and 2 is what counted, you know, mm-hmm. because now you had the backup of arachidonic acid. And with montelukast inhibiting the lipoxygenase pathway, the arachidonic acid, which is the substrate for all of the inflammatory mediators, is also the substrate for the anti-inflammatory mediators as well. So mm-hmm. you begin to shift it in the other direction to the anti-inflammatory mediators. When SARS-CoV-2 bound onto its receptor, on the ACE2 receptor, it activates phospholipase lipase A2, resulting in increased arachidonic acid. And so if you can, I think the reason it worked was that it was a shift from pro-inflammatory to anti-inflammatory mediators because of the inhibition of cyclooxygenase, the blocking of lipoxygenase, and then colchicine, which, as you had described, was inhibiting not only macrophage infiltration, but also microtubule function so that vesicles could not be released. So anti-inflammatory, pro-inflammatory mediators could not be released any further.
Mm-hmm. You're probably gratified.
Oh, and one more thing about the reason that I chose to go with a higher dose aspirin is, if you remember, COVID-19 patients came into the ER, they were very hypoxic, okay? And naturally, the first test they would get initially would be a CT angiogram, which would come back, unless they were advanced into the pneumonia stage, would often come back clear. So how could these people be hypoxic, okay, and have a clear CTA, but have D-dimers that are through the roof? And the reason it had to be, and turned out to be the case, was that it was pulmonary microthrombi mm-hmm. Within the tissues. It wasn't large vessels that you could see in a CTA, but it was microthrombi within the capillary beds of the lungs. That was the first step in triggering the cytokine storm. So if you hit platelets hard, okay, they can't form clots. And as you well know, too, from all of your work with the vaccine, it actually, that's the problem with the vaccine, is the spike protein causing coagulation. So
it's true. You know, I had David Scheim on my show, former NIH researcher, and he believes all the serious manifestations of the infection and the vaccine are due to micro aggregation of red blood cells and microthrombi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as a sidebar, I'll tell you that when I got Moderna vaccine here in the clinic, I gave it out. I have a small practice, and I gave it out to everyone who was 65 and over. But after seeing what had happened in the ICU with these dialysis machines, clogging, their filters over and over again, I started people on aspirin, 650 milligrams twice a day to start the day before, and to continue for 1 week afterwards. Fortunately, we didn't have any side effects of any of our patients, you know, and these were older, frail, rather infirmed patients. So it's anecdotal, but I think it's accurate.
I remember that discussion when the vaccines rolled. I remember talking to my boss at the time, Kevin Whelan, who actually worked with me on the early protocols, and we actually talked about, should we just give prophylaxis, some prophylaxis before the vaccine, because we knew it was going to be a rough vaccine. And And the health system strictly said that, you know, we shouldn't advise this, but everyone was trying to figure out different strategies. Well, tell us how the protocol evolved over time and how you ultimately formalized it.
So initially it involved only colchicine, montelukast, and aspirin. Then as time went on, I began, I looked at the mortality data in New York City. And it was very interesting because these were government figures. And when I looked at these figures, it was very curious because whites were underrepresented with respect to their population by about 4 to 5%. Blacks and Hispanics were overrepresented by about between 4 and 6%. Yeah. Non-Hispanic Asians make up 14% of the population of New York City, and they accounted for only 7% of the deaths. So they were underrepresented with respect to their population by 50%. Now, this is March of 2020. This is the data from March of 2020. It's indisputable. It's real. It was on their newyorkstate.gov. Mm-hmm. And so I started thinking about what else could we possibly do? Like, what are the characteristics of all of these people? And especially the non-Hispanic Asians. And it turns out that obesity rates correlate very well with those percentages. So only 12% of non-Hispanic Asians are actually obese, whereas for whites, it's about 45%, Hispanics, 49%, Blacks, 47%. The mortality rate in New York City for all comers was 280 per 100,000. If you were Black or Hispanic and over the age of 65, the mortality rate ballooned to over 2,400 per 100,000. It was almost 10 times as high.
Oh, my Lord.
Now, for whites, it was still high. It was 1,500. And for non-Hispanic Asians, it was much lower, I think around 700 to 800. So these are the risk factors we already knew about. You know, age, of course, but age and obesity was really deadly. Age and obesity, and what I think is also melanin, is a triple threat. Because when you look at population data with COVID-19, morbidity and mortality increases in northern hemispheres. So you wonder, well, is there another disease process which is more prevalent in northern hemispheres? It's more prevalent, and is there some common denominator between a northern exposure and increased incidence and prevalence of a disease? And it actually, there is a disease like that. It's called multiple sclerosis.
Mm-hmm.
So multiple sclerosis is more prevalent and more exacerbations in northern hemispheres because of decreased sunlight. And that's where I began to explore the idea of, well, it turns out if you think about what neurologists treat their patients to decrease exacerbations of vitamin D, and this is a slightly controversial, there's data to support it and not to support it, but it's commonly done. They supplement their MS patients with vitamin D.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the key point behind, and now why would vitamin D be important? Well, it's a fat-soluble vitamin. If you are obese, I have never met a patient who's obese who is not has low vitamin D or at least is deficient. And if you think about the biggest question with this is what level do they treat to? What do they treat their MS patients to? And that is 60 to 65 nanograms per ml.
Wow.
Okay. Now, if you look on your blood work and you look at what is considered to be sufficient, okay, it would be anything above 30 nanograms per ml. That's what's considered to be sufficient and normal. Okay, well, It turns out that if MS being an autoimmune disease, COVID-19 is an autoimmune disease, I think we should be treating people for at least to a level of 65 nanograms per ml. And why is vitamin D so important? Well, it turns out that vitamin D is critical for a proper function of T suppressor cells. So there's the imbalance. If you're and if you have melanin in your skin, sure, you don't wrinkle as much as we do, but you don't convert the vitamin D you have into an activated form. So vitamin D, I think, was critical. And I started supplementing people with vitamin D with actually 50,000 international units daily for 6 days.
Wow. How early in 2020 or 2021 did you start doing that?
This was probably by September of 2020.
Really?
September, October. Yeah.
Wow.
And in order to also help people with, because I was a little worried about the aspirin, I came across studies using famotidine, that famotidine had some antiviral properties as well.
Yes.
So I said, aha, great. I'll protect their stomach, patient's stomachs, and additionally, I'll have an antiviral component to it as well. So that ultimately, we kind of nicknamed it the COVIMAC Plus protocol.
What was the dose of famotidine you chose?
Just 20 milligrams twice a day.
Okay. Yeah, so we were thinking independently but separately. So I had vitamin D in McCullough protocol originally, but it was only at 5,000 units, which is just kind of a standard daily dose. And believe it or not, I had a conversation with Dermot O'Flynn, who's the personal physician of Eric Clapton. I got a chance to know Eric Clapton through this whole thing. And he's more of a naturopathic doctor, and he kind of reviewed all this with me. He goes, listen, he goes, vitamin D is a therapy at some point in time, he goes, but at much higher doses. So he had convinced me, and I upgraded it to 20,000 units a day for 5 to 30 days. And if I was to redo it now, I'd be at the downing dose of 50,000 units. You know, I think if you went on forever and ever, there'd be a risk of kidney stones, but not over a matter of days.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
Now famotidine is interesting. I was following this story in this paper by Mira and colleagues from University of Virginia. The famotidine dose, as I recall, was 80 milligrams. It was four times the usual dose. So it was being used for its kind of antihistamine, antiviral properties. And so that was in there. But the nice thing about so far this, we'll call it the Downing protocol, is you haven't hit any hot buttons. You know, anybody could have done this. Anybody could have prescribed this out of their office or out of the ER. And, you know, in a sense, it was off the radar screen of what was happening with the NIH and pharmacists and others.
Yeah, unfortunately, at that point in time, it was necessary to stay under the radar. So right. I treated it like... eventually, the administration of the hospital found out about what I was doing, and it allowed me to continue to do it. So they were fine with it for a while. And then, unfortunately, we have another hospital in Venice, and it turned out to be an administrative thing. And at this point, I thought, well, we're done with COVID anyhow. We've been doing this for a year, almost a year and a half, and the newer variants that were coming out were not nearly as dangerous. It was mostly causing upper respiratory issues, not lower respiratory issues. I still treat people. I still, with the same protocol, I had an 88-year-old woman in the hospital who I put on the protocol, and she's in rehab now. So it's certainly the variant is not as deadly, and I think it's probably due to the fact that it's not causing microthrombi within the vasculature. But that doesn't mean that, as you well know, that that another variant could develop that could return to that mechanism of action too.
It's true. So tell us about your patent.
I applied for it initially in July 9th of 2020. And the reason is I was under the mistaken impression that some pharmaceutical company would hear about it. And this goes back to my colleague, Dr. Galwankar. He was, at this time, he was doing podcasts throughout the world, live podcasting. And when I met him in July of 2020 and I explained what I was doing, he said, "You've got to come to my podcast. You've got to tell the world about this." And this was like Wednesday. And it's on Saturday. It's 8 o'clock in the morning. People from all around the world are going to listen. "You've got to come and do this." And I'm like, "I've never done anything like this before." Of course, I didn't sleep for a couple of nights. But I thought about it and I said, well, and I spoke to some of my patients who were retired pharmaceutical executives. And I said, "Look, if I let this out into the world, what's going to stop any company, pharmaceutical company, from grabbing it, grabbing the idea and running with it?" And they said, "Well, you should apply for a patent."
Wow.
And somehow we made the application in July 9th. And I think July 12th, I think we did the podcast. And of course, the no pharmaceutical industry was interested in anything that would actually prevent COVID-19. It turned out to be, I have a nice little, piece of paper that I'll probably frame. And I can say that I have a patent, but it doesn't really mean anything.
Sean, was the patent for the prevention of COVID-19 or for the treatment and then prevention of the bad outcomes?
It was very widely, it cast a very wide net, in fact. And okay. I'm surprised they got it approved. And that was for any use of colchicine, aspirin, or montelukast for systemic acute respiratory syndrome from SARS-CoV-2.
Wow. Okay, great. That's absolutely true. You did that.
Well, it's not worth the paper it's written on, but it's a nice story.
No, but it's the fact you did it. You also published a case. We'll cite that. And the reason why I was so motivated to have you on the show, like I've had Dr. Sankara Shetty on the show, is that you figured out how to do this and treat patients. And in a sense, you avoided the hot button. I mean, let's face it, hydroxychloroquine was a hot button. The ivermectin was a hot button. People got all tangled up with monoclonal antibodies, steroids. You know, at the time, Pierre Corey testified in the Senate in May of 2020 on steroids. Every single guidelines body said, "Don't use steroids." They actually said specifically, "Don't use steroids." The NIH. So when my dad got sick with COVID, at that time, the prevailing view was, "Don't use steroids." And so, you really figured out how to do this. Now, truth be told, this kind of core nucleus that you came up with, you know, adding other drugs probably could even further ease the situation, like azithromycin or doxycycline or indeed hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or steroids, right? Or some combination of. I've always said it takes 4 to 6 drugs for a really sick senior to get through the illness. And that's probably the case, about 4 to 6 drugs. But I've always said, John, no single drug is necessary nor sufficient, that there's many ways to skin a cat.
Well, I agree completely because, you know, and I've heard this ad nauseum, is the idea that as I would approach colleagues about this, they would say, "Well, there are no randomized controlled trials." Mm-hmm. And in fact, when there were randomized controlled trials being done, it was typically with one single drug.
Right.
And so, of course, they were all equivocal. They were all, it was very rare to get a positive result, although the cold corona actually had a positive result. It was interesting. It had positive results in people who were who actually tested positive. There was another group of people that they hadn't tested, and it didn't show a difference. No surprise there. But it was... Yeah, it was an interesting time, for sure.
John, I'll give you a little fun fact. I was a subject myself in the co-corona trial.
No way.
Yeah, because I had COVID early. I was seeking clinical trials, and I reached out. I knew about co-corona trial, and I contacted the center, and I ended up enrolling over the computer. And was accepted, and they shipped the medicine out to me. Now the protocol, as I recall, was colchicine 0.6 milligrams twice a day for 3 days, and then once a day thereafter for 30 days total. So it was a longer trial. And I filled out my logs, and they followed up, what have you. And then at the end of the day, and the trial was a positive trial. It was over 4,000 patients. It reduced the composite hospitalization and death. There weren't enough deaths for that singular endpoint to be positive, but it was a positive trial in those who had COVID, like me. I really had the illness. But when we broke the blind, it turned out I had placebo. So people need to know. Yeah. So people need to know, when you're in clinical trials, you get randomized to the real drug or placebo. And you're right. We need clinical trials of greater than 20,000 people in each group for these singular test agents. And then we need to get in multi-drug trials. So you did the same thing as so many of us did. We looked for signals of benefit, the right mechanism of action, and then our early clinical observations and get people through. And it's so interesting to see how you and Dr. Chetty in South Africa, on a sad note, unfortunately, even though he never used hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin, and he used kind of a combination like you did, he's been brought up on charges by his medical board, and now he's being threatened to lose his license for treating COVID patients. So
I hope that doesn't happen to me. So.
Hopefully, it's saner times. We're drawing to a close now with Dr. Downing, who's an internist and also trained in pediatrics. He's located in Sarasota, Florida, and we've heard about that. We'll call it the Downing Protocol, but it's so nice to chat with a fellow internist. At Sage Advice, we want to thank Dr. Sean Downing for joining us on McCullough Report. What a great interview. Great to meet you. And we're better off for your work and the work of so many doctors like you, who really stepped out, had the courage to face the illness.
Well, thank you for being there for us, because you are a national figure for us. You're speaking for all of us, and it's an honor and a privilege to be here. And please keep up the great work that you're doing.
Thank you. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Loud Talk Radio. This is a McCullough Report.